Writing the Wrong Way. We talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And a little bit of apology on the sound quality of this one. Me and Gregory Kremichik were just finished wrapping a movie when we decided late at night, past midnight, that we would, you know, just kind of give our bit of our thoughts on having wrapped this movie. We were co-writers on a movie that's going to be coming out at some point called The Princess and the Dragon, co-writers and producers on the film. And yeah, so here's our thoughts. While tired, rambling, and recording poorly on my iPhone, with our feet on the table and probably kicking it from time to time, you know. But I think, you know, some interesting little insights into the world of movie making and sort of what it feels like to wrap production on a feature film. So, hope you enjoy, and keep writing the wrong way.
How's it feeling now?
Okay,
now that we have
wrapped production on The Princess and the Dragon.
Are you recording already? Is this happening?
Yeah, we don't need to worry about it too much. But just, you know, just for posterity, for our few little feelings and thoughts.
Oh, a few feelings and thoughts. Okay, let me pull up a chair. Let me sip my coconut water. Let me put my feet up on the rented abode that we are staying in because we're out in Brandon. And we did the last day of shooting in the Restore in Brandon,
yeah.
Which doubled as the basement for the old sanatorium that we shot in Nynette. And it was actually a stroke of genius, I think, that Miles Crossman had to find that location, which gave us a lot more control, and have the suggestion that all of the puzzles and silly mind games and all that kind of stuff that's in the floors above are something that are reset and rebuilt regularly by people who run it. It gave us a real nice sort of dovetail of those two ideas. So my thoughts about that as I was watching it all unfold today were, this is a cool idea we didn't come up with, and these scenes we didn't write.
The resetting stuff?
Yeah, like the setting, which gives a layer for the story. But then also this, like, armored up medieval combat sequence wasn't in our original draft. This sort of cat and mouse game between the dragon and princess was, but not in this context. And it was just really cool to be a part of a story that evolved the more minds that got sort of drawn close to it. And that's sort of how I was feeling. Instead of like, oh man, I wish we got the ending that we wrote, it felt more like an ending I wouldn't have written. And yet, here we were, a part of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it, the parameters of it are the same. Like, the action sequence is different.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's an action sequence and the big beats of it, like cutting the, cutting the key, doing all that, smashing the helmet, seeing the face,
yeah,
seeing the mouth done up, you know, it was all, we had it faster and we had it, kind of less talking, more of a faster action sequence. We weren't making as much of a meal out of it, as they say.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to kind of see it stretched out and kind of, yeah, like use, like the facility, as you say, the location is used a lot more in the sequence we just shot.
Because
you spent almost all day shooting one sequence.
Yeah. But like the thing I'm trying to get at, maybe not so eloquently, because we shot from 9 till midnight, 9 a.m. till midnight straight.
Yeah.
My ineloquence is perhaps a result of that. But the notion that I'm trying to establish is, it was cool to stand inside a version of an idea.
Right.
That had a beginning in some place I totally understood, and it went a place. And the part of me that will write drafts of prose novels or comics or whatever and pants it a little bit, just sort of let the story tell me how it's going to end, I felt that, except I was standing there in it. And that was a real cool experience to be part of the director's vision that saw further than the script draft.
A good way to put it. It's like, it's kind of like seeing further, because it is very much like an extension of what was there in the script into kind of like a bit more of a fleshed out, more realized, in this case, climax at fight sequence.
But for me, like, the best part about making independent movies, you know, and I've never worked on anything with an enormous budget, so I've only stood near things that had big budgets. And so to be on an independent film, what's interesting about it to me is that the experience is the value. Whether or not you can assemble the film into something passable, usable, marketable, you know, something with a life beyond itself, an independent film rarely can pull that off. And so it's more, to me, it's always been, in all the times that I've done it, related to, in these, in our case, 9 days of shooting, can a whole bunch of people who have never really worked together all that well or closely come together and get themselves aligned to get a single idea out by all working together? And no one has the full picture. Sometimes no one has even 5%, 10% of the picture, and yet they can hold their peace just enough to make it work.
You said an interesting thing today, which was there's an idea from the DOP, and you pointed out to someone, like, on a larger set, like a bigger budget movie, that'd be like a fireable effect.
Yeah.
But on an indie set, it's like, oh, that's a cool idea. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So the scene, just for posterity's sake, was that the reporter from the Brandon Sun had come and happened to be taking photos and watching what they thought was a very interesting exchange, a creative, collaborative exchange of the director saying an idea, the DP saying, oh, but what if we do this? And then one of the grips saying, oh, and you could do this. And then the actress saying, oh, you could do this. And I pointed out to the reporter, like, this is, because our movie is way below the $1 million mark, right? Creative collaboration is encouraged. Once you're above the $1 million mark, you almost get fired for any suggestion that you would deign to put forward.
Well, what's the largest budget set you've been on yourself?
On or near? Well, the biggest productions I've ever been around were actually musical or theater productions, which even on an indie set here, to the scale of hundreds of thousands to $1 million, you know?
Sure.
Then things go wrong and someone is in a lot of trouble.
See, I've been on a couple sets where the budget was $5 million, a little upwards, but around $5 million, which is a sizable budget in Canada.
Yeah.
I've been on a few $1-2 million sets and then a couple $5 million sets. And, you know, they were good sets run by good people, but it very quickly becomes a slog because it's so many people. There's just so many people. And it, you know, it really doesn't help to have the money at a certain point. Like, you think it does, but it just slows things down. There's an insurance guy there. There's lawyers, you know.
Well, okay.
It becomes, but and they start to throw money at things, you know. And so I think you had a really, it was a really interesting comment you made, because I was like, this, even if it's not run in a draconian fashion where they're going to shut down creativity, even if you have a director who is encouraging creativity, that system doesn't really encourage it because it's just too much money. It's got to move fast. It's got to move fast. It's got to move fast. Like,
and the first AD will say, no, Right. And everyone has to listen and move on.
And, you know, like, on one hand, like, we didn't want to shoot 15 hours today. We wanted to shoot 12. But we do have the luxury of going a little longer. You know, no one's necessarily pleased about it when that happens. Yeah. But everyone kind of gets, like, well, it makes sense. Like, you know?
Okay,
like,
when it's a small thing, when you're behind, you're all behind.
Yeah. You're all, like, you all get it. Yeah. Even if you're not happy about it, you're not, like, angry about it. You know what I mean? Like, you just kind of like, okay, yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Whereas a larger set, they'll start shutting it down.
Yeah. The other thing I found really interesting and fun about today, and I'll say something that I said just before you started recording. It's fun to be on a set standing beside the director, right? I was having a lot of fun because I get to be present in my sort of unofficial roles that I had today and doing a lot of different hats. I got to be present in a lot of the fun conversations and watch the director make a decision, watch the DP make a decision, watch the performers make decisions about their performance and put it all together. So I got to have a lot of fun watching that, standing beside someone who is now responsible to make it all work, you know, which
I said to my daughter, I was like, you know, I was thinking like, man, I'm feeling, having fun making this movie stuff. And she was saying, oh yeah, you should do more movies maybe. I was like, well, it was fun when you don't really have to do anything. And you're not really, like, I'm choosing to do a bunch of things, but I don't have to do them.
Yeah. You know?
Like, I'm kind of in a privileged position in that way. Like, mostly our real work is done. We're, like, choosing to take on other work.
Well, it's so hard to be on an indie film, any film at all, but on an indie film in particular because the budgets are small. If you're just a grip, you don't get to see almost anything that you're setting up. You don't get to be present when any of the cool decisions are happening. You basically move some light stands and then go sit and be quiet for an hour, and then you move some more light stands and you sit and be quiet for another hour. So that's not easy for are the unsung heroes.
You become more of a slog for sure.
Yeah.
When you're not being asked to contribute in these other ways.
And there's a vulnerability in performance. I mean, we're doing it's a horror movie, but the psychological component of Nadine, of our principal character, is to go through a lot of emotions in this horrible ordeal and wear them on their face. But it's not like theater where you can rev up and for 2 hours be in that feeling. It's okay, we're going to do it for 7 minutes, then we're going to wait for 15, then we're going to pick up from where you were emotionally 15 minutes ago and make sure you hit the same beat as you were at the end of the last 7 minutes, and escalate it, please. So you get to sort of be around that and I found myself becoming very protective of that creative process, the same way that I'm very protective of my own writing time, my own drawing time, my own creative time. And I can get real obsessive about being protective of that time. I felt that same feeling, like, oh, this is what we have to maintain. This is what we have to create a little bubble for. This is what we got to try to do. For better or worse, we got to, you know, just get through it.
It is a weird thing in film, I think, because it's like, it's unlike other art forms insofar as you're really crashing, like, an art process against a very practical, it's almost like a construction set.
It's like an engineering problem.
Yeah.
Built around
the scaffolding. It's like you're building a house, and you got carpenters, and you got, like, you know, like, lighting techs, it's like carpenters, plumbers, electricians, building a house, putting the whole thing together, and then also you're trying to make art inside of it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very back and forth, you know. And it's interesting.
And one of our production managers made a point while we were having a kind of a difficult scene where it was hard to hit the emotional mark. He said, you know, guys, we could do this sequence like they do on, and he spends a lot of time on much bigger budget, like, you know, sort of quote unquote real movies. He said, you know, when the actor is performing, everyone turns around, you know, you don't watch them perform. You leave them their space. for just the director and the DP to see the performance, and everyone turns their back. And I don't know if that's universally true, but that's something that I definitely, it's not been my experience to see that. So I'd be curious to know performers that are demanding it, you know, asking for it. I understand it. I completely understand it. Because it was a better take when we weren't watching and they had that freedom to just be present and do it just for the camera. They were freer to do it.
It is like a thing where you'll get into the specifics of different people's processes, you know. And like some actors are method actors, some actors kind of turn it on and off. Some actors, you know, they're kind of used to the theater, as you say, and they're trying to like adapt that for film. Like everyone's got a different process for acting. There's not just one acting process, right? So these different schools, these different methods, whatever you want to call them. And then at the same time, you know, you got your DOP and your director, they are coming at it from a particular stylistic approach as well. And so it's curious because a lot of the times those people don't really have a communication, you know, like, if you think about it, like the director and DOP, they get on the same page about like cinematically how they're approaching things, right? But the actor doesn't often know that.
Yeah.
Which they don't need to know it either, but it kind of, you know, it is a curious thing. Whereas other actors are very aware, like Tom Cruise is extremely aware of where the camera is framing him, to the point where he'll direct people using his hand outside of the frame while he's shooting and acting. But that's, you know, not everyone has that level of familiarity.
Well, not everyone is, frankly, living most of their life on a movie set.
Jay Moore tells a great story about when he was shooting Jerry Maguire with him, right? And see, he said he was shooting this scene with Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise had it, was like doing all these weird things with his hand, like in the corner of his eye. And he's like, what the fuck's going on? But he was like directing like the crew and while he was doing the scene. like not entirely as directed.
Yeah.
He was like giving notes and doing things, but he had everything out. He knew where the frame was exactly.
Right.
And he could just do the thing at the same time, you know, even back then. But you know, a lot, very few people have that familiarity with both sides of the camera.
It just comes down to experience, you know. Like we're building experience now. Yeah, we can
yeah.
say all we want about what we know, and it's so small compared to what there is to learn, and also what is possible when everyone is working together in real concert. Like there was a few moments today where it all was working and everyone's
mm-hmm.
little contribution stacked up into this amazing bit. Just the right amount of haze, just the right amount of bounce light, just the right amount of diffusion, just the right pacing, entering frame, just the right, you know, flourish in the performance, and it all like stacks up together. And you don't even know if that'll make it into the movie. But in that moment, you just feel so, like, I don't know, alive, frankly.
Yeah, it's a really interesting medium, and it's the only thing that I find frustrating about it is it's so slow. I don't find shooting on a set to be that slow. It can be, but like production itself is not that slow. It almost is too fast, you know, in some ways. Like it can feel slow because you're always behind schedule. But you often are moving pretty fast. When else, like, you know, like in our case here, we had what, total of 9 days.
Yeah.
The whole feature film shot in 9 days. So yes, the days are kind of spread apart in a certain way, but like basically that's not long to shoot a movie. Like a full length feature film. And really like our pre-production was pretty short, all things considered, but like that's often quite long. And that was much longer.
Yeah, 9 days.
And then post is always crazy,
you know,
long.
And 9 days or 18 regular work days. Because that's
yeah,
what
that's
we stacked into those 9 days.
It is, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But
on a saner production schedule, it'd be 18 days.
Right, because when I say 9 days, they're pretty well 15-hour days.
Yeah.
But it's still, you know, most of the movie is post and pre-production. In many respects, and so it, you know, it's a weird art form in that way, I find. But it's invigorating just to see all the different aspects of it. You know, you get to have music, you get to have photography, you get to have, you know, these art elements, design art elements. You get acting, you get, you know, the performative elements. You know, it, it's it's a great medium insofar as all these things come together. You get writing, of course, goes into that. Like all the art forms kind of crash together in a film, which is great, but it's also a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, they're all subsumed by one another.
Yeah.
Right? There's a really great moment today about that, like that consumption of one idea eating the other. We're setting up what's a very theoretically simple shot. We have the lights flagged off, everything's fine. And something I didn't know about how a fluorescent light can create that flicker as you're catching it. They're not seeing it on the monitor, they're not seeing it on the light gate, light meters, and so they're like, oh, I guess it's fine. That's weird that it's fine, but we're not getting any. And then it was just that they were getting the wrong readings, and once they started doing it, of course, then they have to, you know. So now all the writing, all the performance, all the setup is in service to the light that they're going to put in place. And now that the light is there, it casts a certain shadow, so then that changes the mark, which then changes the performance, which then changes. And so, like, the whole process is completely rewritten in a way by a simple need to put a light somewhere.
Yeah, it can be frustrating, but I think it's sort of fascinating to me how it boils down to those really practical things.
Yeah, totally.
So often.
Or like, we're going to do a pickup shot of the key going in, a little insert shot, and then it breaks, right? Because it's just a prop, the key in the lock, and it snaps. It doesn't quite work. It's like a skeleton key. It breaks in the lock. So now the idea to show the whole action of the key going in, turning, and coming all the way up. Well, now, no. Now we're going to cut to the reaction of the door opening because we're just going to infer now that the key came out and use the previous scene where she puts the key on the table to let everyone know what happened to the key so that it's in continuity in the storyline. All because the prop broke and you don't have time to make another one. So.
Well, wasn't there another one upstairs? We had a bunch of
them. No, but the other one had broken also in a different prop block. Fine. And so we had the backup, so it's fine. And then it was like, okay, if it breaks, this is the plan. So you have a plan A and a plan B, and you know, you just go.
Yeah, where we had that vase was breaking.
Yeah.
You got two vases, you can do it two times. Did we use two?
Yeah. We used them both, yeah.
Yeah.
And the second take was the super
two.
Take.
What I find, don't you find that that's always the case, though? Like, what I feel is the most fascinating thing about any art form is I feel like for all the aspirations that are the high-minded aspirations of the artist, for all you know, you have this really complicated, you know, a thematic idea or conceptual idea or whatever it is, I find it just so often just comes down to a real technical thing. Like whether it's writing, it's like you got to use one less syllable or it won't sound sad. Or it's like, you know, the editing, you need to take out 2 seconds. It's 2 seconds are slowing you down.
Mm.
Or if it's like you're on the set and it's like the lights needs to flicker a third time. You know,
and on film, 2 seconds is a lot. Yeah. Because 2 seconds at the beginning maybe takes the tension out, and 2 seconds at the end takes the pathos out, and
I find it just is, it so often boils down to like such a real weird, super technical thing. That I find that so often makes the difference between something that's just fine and something that's really great.
Mm.
You know, and it's weird because it's hard to, it doesn't seem like that would be the case, you know. But I find it's so often the case, like the wrong word, or if you're a comedian, it's just inflecting the wrong word ruins the joke.
Yeah.
You know? And it can be that specific. Steve Martin used to have a great joke, which is that he used to say, the reason why he was so great as a comedian was he had the thing that all great comedians have, timing. Timing! But like, I find it so often just that technical, like really specific thing, which is hard to explain to someone because it doesn't always make sense. And it's not always a rule-based thing. You know, like so many things in writing or other art forms, like there's kind of these principles, these guidelines, these things that tend to work and these craft elements you can teach somebody. But then so often they'll be like the exception or some really specific weird thing where it's like, no, if you say it just a little bit faster it'll work. But you don't necessarily know why. It just sort of starts to come down to this weird technical, almost, you know, it's not a feeling, but it kind of starts to become like an instinct. It's hard to explain sometimes, but you can see people like aligning, like, oh yeah, no, it needs to be a little bit, your eyes, like, you know, your eyes can't look at his eyes or won't look like they're looking at his eyes. You know, like, that's the kind of weirdness you'll get into.
Yeah, that's specifically happened on set, where it's like, okay, the way that it's framed and the way the camera is positioned, you have to look at his chin so that it looks to the audience like he's looking at his eyes.
Yeah.
The way we've got the camera over your shoulder.
It gets so specific and so technical in such a way that is hard to explain or predict.
Well, and it's like in those moments where that's where people's specialization are making up for a lack of vision. And because you can't always see it all clearly, right? I don't mean lack of vision like, oh, it's a bad idea. I mean, like, you just can't see all of the things. And a person could say, oh, well, we'll change the frame rate, or we'll change the lens, or we'll just, you know, knock this light down 20% and it'll solve all our problems.
Is that difference that's hard to explain to people starting out? Is that difference between a professional standard and like a person starting out standard?
Oh,
you know what I mean? Like, or an amateur, let's
say. We were running the razor's edge of this professional standard with a crew that some people had a wealth of experience, like 20 years, 30 years of film experience, and other people that have 2 months of film experience.
Yeah.
And so you're just, everyone is trying to find that middle. And so I guess you get the average, which is great if you have people with real experience on set.
Yeah, like in the previous days, like on the other set, it was a larger crew, and so you had more of that. And so there were like, especially on that set, you know, some people who were a lot less experienced than, say, who we were shooting with today. And, you know, with some other people also with more experience. So you still got that kind of average. But, you know, I remember there's a bit more on, not today, but on the other set, there's a bit more like explaining to a couple of people, no, this is like how it works on a set. Like, you know, it's got to be this way, and, you know, it's not like this. But it's kind of an unusual thing, you know. And every set's different, but there are those, I find this when I teach writing, it's one of the hardest things because I don't know how to explain it well. But it's really hard to explain like that difference between what's like a professional standard and what is not a professional standard. Because sometimes it's so fine and so, you know, it's not always easy to differentiate, but it is a clear differentiation often. And it's hard to know how to move from one to the other.
So you professional, you know, if you're quibbling to say, that, you know, someone might pay you for it, as professional, it's good enough that another person would, you know, part with their hard-earned money. I think it's what you really mean is
that... It's not really that.
Yeah, I know. So for me, what it comes down to are the actions you're taking as an artist, as a writer, as an illustrator, as a filmmaker, are those actions a distillation of a larger idea? Or are they the whole idea? And if they're the whole idea, you're an amateur. And if they're a distillation of a larger idea, you're likely a professional.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Yeah. It's curious because it is sort of the... It's almost, I think, a backstory a lot. It's hard to explain to somebody that, no, you don't want to put all the backstory and flesh the whole story out in this thing. You want to hint at a backstory. Mm-hmm. Because then it'll seem like there's more backstory you're not saying. But if you say all the backstory, it seems like there's no backstory. It's so weird. You know, like, you get into those sorts of things. But you're right. Like, it's like the distillation of a larger thing.
Mm-hmm.
It suggests this greater world. Like with this set, a lot of things we're kind of doing or trying to do are these smaller touches. Like,
the trying
thing
is a
in
good
the background.
Word. The thing we're trying to do,
there's a thing in the background. There's the design on the wall, you know, around this log. there's all these finer details where, like, if you're watching the movie and you're looking and you're paying attention and you're seeing things in this, in the background, you're noticing, like, what the shape of that key is, you're noticing this, you're noticing that. If you really are paying attention, you can kind of start putting pieces together and, like, seeing, oh, there's this larger idea in the background of, you know, that's
and,
not really...
And big. Literally in the background, literally in the production design, we put these posters that were, you know, they masquerade as inspirational or aspirational posters almost, with these slogans that are, you know, in many ways the subtext presented as a background element. And so if you watch it the first time, you're just watching the hope is that a work of art, film in particular, is worth seeing more than once. And if you achieve that, then the reason you'd want to see it more than once is so you could notice something you knew was present the first time, but you were putting your attention on the action or the performance. But if you had seen that performance already and you watched again, you'd see another larger picture. And the frame of the idea gets wider the more often you watch it until, and like cult films do this, the mythology begins to grow even into the unexplored, unshown, unshot elements. And that's where the cult status of a film comes, when people have watched it so many times that their imagination is so invested that they now color outside all the lines of every scene, building lore and building, as they say, headcanon about around the story and just building their own versions of what it all means. A good movie like that is in that B movie, you know, So Bad It's Good categories, Big Trouble in Little China. There's a whole cult following around that film, which is about all the bits of mythology that are never explained.
The weird thing is, you can't have that if you try to put all that stuff in the
movie. Yeah, if it was in it, you wouldn't like it.
Yeah.
It's because they don't tell you that it's interesting, because then you can imagine what the answer is.
Yeah, it's such a weird fine line, though, you know, like, because there's some invisible line where once you cross it, there's too much of that stuff.
See, like, David Mamet plays, David Mamet movies have that great outside the frame suggestion, because characters, at least in his writing, never talk about, never explain something that they'd never explain.
Right.
And so you have to infer in context what they're talking about, because they don't clearly say.
That's my great complaint. My wife used to watch these procedurals, these crime procedurals, like CSI and things like that. And I would always like complain about it, because I'm like, they're in a lab, they work in the lab every day together, and they're just telling one another, like, now I'm going to put the blood in the spinner and it'll tell us this. It's like, why would you talk about, like, you
talk about something else.
You talk about it, you talk about, like, how you went to the movies the other day. You talk about anything else other than the thing you're doing every single day.
A great element of that, just as like as a fan, a consumer of it, Homicide: Life on the Street, that old, that was a procedural that wasn't a procedural. The police officers never spoke about the case to each other. They spoke about everything but the case, because they knew how to do the case. So of course they're not going to explain it to each other. Right.
Yeah.
So they would, and it was, you know, it's intensely interesting because they're at work doing what most people do at work, not talk about work.
All right. But yeah, I mean, I get, like, you know, it's curious. Anyway, it's been a very interesting experience, because it's been a while since I've really been in the film world doing things. You know, it's been a break, quite a break actually. And I hadn't really thought about it, but it really has been since, I think the last time I consciously was doing things in film, other than that TV, crime TV show we were writing for briefly. Other than that, and I guess I did a feature film script with the director, like, in pre-pandemic, what was that? But other than that, those two little projects, I really hadn't done significant film work since 2009, 2008,
so you got 7. All your, you're getting all those itches scratched by doing comics, because you get to write scripts, you get to direct the action, but your budgets are unlimited. We can crush the moon in a spider's legs.
Now that I think about it, I've done a bit more than I Yeah, but still, like, it hasn't felt like I've been going in these waves, you know, like up and down for where every couple of years I'll do. Like,
but we also wrote
stuff, and then yeah, actually, you know, now that I think about it, it's been like 10 projects.
Yeah, like let's just talk about all these unproduced things.
I always forget about things that don't get produced, but yeah. But nevertheless, you know, it films one of those things. Just for me, it goes in waves because I'm not always doing it. Even if I'm always kind of dipping my toes in it here and there, you know, I'm often in comics lately, or you know, just writing books or whatever. Like it's just usually I'm in a realm where there's a little less collaboration, or at least there's less people involved in the collaboration. So it's been really refreshing to kind of do something of this scale where it's not so big you're kind of lost in the shuffle, but it's small enough. It's still big enough that, you know, you got lots of people involved, you know. And it's been great meeting a bunch of the people involved and, like, kind of just, you know, connecting more fully to some... It's really made the idea bigger in me a little bit, you know.
What I've really enjoyed about it, and I guess this kind of ties back to what we talked about at the beginning, all these people took the idea and made it bigger.
Yeah, sure.
Right? They didn't make it smaller. They didn't, like, take out all the good parts and just whittle it away until there was nothing left. It got bigger.
Yeah, which just happens sometimes in film, especially.
It got bigger. The idea got bigger. And as a result, we tried to add to that largesse with some production design and some rewrites and some things like that. And, you know, but who knows? I think we've got some great stuff. It's all in a pile now. And
now you gotta add sound,
you gotta edit it, you gotta do full, you gotta ADR, you gotta market, you gotta, you know, all that stuff. So much can still go wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll see how it goes, I suppose. But
one went right as we finished today. So that's awesome.
That's a great note to end the recording on, and you know, maybe we'll eat a few chips now.
Now we can eat
some chips.
Now
we shall eat chips.